take the time, make the trip. It depends on where you live, obviously. You've got to spend some money and go places and spend some time in that area learning that market and going, and you need to go see those brokers.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Good day, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm so excited to have our guest, Tracy Hubbard, on from Hubbard Capital Group. Tracy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. So everybody, Tracy is a real estate investor and syndicator, professional Forex trader, and serial entrepreneur, having owned and operated six companies across various industries. Tracy has traded in the financial markets for the last 20 years and owned six businesses, and he can translate those experiences into real estate. So Tracy, I know you just have so much life experience to share with our listeners. Why don't you take us back in time and tell us a bit about your journey and what drew you into real estate?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Thank you. You know, I'm in my 60s. So as you said, I've had a lot of time to have a lot of those experiences, they say. In my previous younger days, I'm a former Marine, United States Marine. So that gave me a lot of building blocks to go off of as far as in my career, as far as learning how to stick with stuff and overcoming any kind of obstacles I might have. And you just can't quit. Just got to keep moving forward. That sort of gave me the base of my career, my entrepreneurial career. Like I said, I've owned several businesses. Well, one of those businesses bankrupted me back in the late 90s. So there I was, 42 years of age with four young children, having to start over. So I had to reinvent myself, and I didn't really know anything about the financial markets at that time, but started going into the financial markets, started trading the markets, and over time gradually became pretty good at it to the point where I ran a couple of hedge funds and traded my own accounts and did very well at it for about 15, 20 years. Then I noticed the market started changing quite a bit in 2015, actually more like in 2008 and 9 when the Fed started getting heavily involved with their quantitative easing and all the different things they did there. Became a little bit more difficult to make consistent money in the markets, financial markets. So that's when I started transferring over into hard assets, real estate being the main one. I want to get in hard assets because of all the things I saw in the financial markets. So
awesome. So you just touched on an entire life story there. So let's go back. And I mean, you know, what was that? What business were you in the 90s? And what was that experience like going through bankruptcy? And how did you come back from that?
Okay, so I bought my first company back in 1987, basically an HVAC service company. Really didn't know a lot about it, but it was a business, a service industry that I understood. So I bought that business and had it for about 2 or 3 years, increased it and then sold it and parlayed that into another industry, which is logistics warehousing. I bought that business in 89, bought that company for $100,000 and ended up selling it for about $1 million. About 3 or 4 years later, I thought I was going to retire. So that's how naive I was. That was right around Desert Storm is when that was, back in 91, 92. And thought I'd retire. I was still very, very young, in my 30s. I never played golf, took up golf, which I'd never done that. That was the biggest waste of time. And so you need to be good at golf or good at your business, because it's hard to be good at both because it takes too much time. So I did that for a few years and got bored and thought I'd go back and buy another business. Bought a manufacturing company, a couple of different companies in there. That was the company that basically bankrupted me. And I won't go into the gory details of it other than to say that I lost everything when we went through bankruptcy. One of these, I'll just file bankruptcy on paper and go start up somewhere else. We literally lost everything. And so I had to figure out what I was going to do and how I was going to recover from it. And that was my first experience, is really having to, quote, really reinvent myself. And I've been in different businesses, and you can always find someone that can be an expert in that business to help you out. But going into the financial markets was a whole new realm. So I had to pretty much self-taught on that thing. That was before the internet was really prolific. So I spent a lot of time traveling across the country trying to figure out how to learn how to trade the markets, going to seminars, talking to people, that kind of thing.
And just real quick, Tracy, just to pause you for a second. So, I mean, I know you had four young children at the time of bankruptcy, like, and we talked before the call about how your military background kind of sort of has influenced your career in business. So was there some sort of mindset that you were able to develop that helped you kind of recover from a pretty difficult place?
Yes. And I would lean on my family for that, you know, very much so. You know, my children being very young, you know, my biggest concern, to be honest with you on that kind of stuff, is when I went through the bankruptcy and I made some mistakes going into up to it and through it by trying to salvage the thing when it was really past repair. And I cashed in everything I had trying to save something that couldn't be saved. And that was a mistake. And that was my pride, basically, not wanting to admit failure on something. My concern was my kids would look at me and say that and look at me and think of me as a failure. But kids are resilient. And their biggest concern was, you know, not that we were going to lose everything, and which, you know, was the house on the golf course, the country club and blah, 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 and private education, all those kind of things. They didn't care about that. All they want to know is that we're a family and we're together. And we were still a family, still together in a much, much smaller little place, barely two pennies rubbed together. But that's all they really cared about. So your family, it helped me get through that. Everybody's a spiritual person. I leaned heavily on my religious beliefs to get me through that. Because some days, you know, you wake up and you just got to get out of bed, whether you want to or not, and keep moving forward. And that's what you got to keep doing. Because sooner or later, if you're not moving forward, you're not going to discover some things. And so it's through that process of just getting up and doing it got me through. Then my wife sat me down and said, hey, you know, this year, because I was getting a little bit, I would say, you know, depressed. And she pretty much looked at me and said one day on the couch, she goes, what are you doing? And I go, what do you mean? What am I doing? And I'm like, today, you want some errands run? She goes, no, what are you doing? Because this is not who you are. You need to get up off the couch and, you know, go do what you do, which is create things and, you know, solve people's problems. And so, you know, she helped me get through that. It was a pretty dark time. So she helped me through that. The reason I didn't want to talk about that, because I thought I may get emotional, which start going down too far down this path. But it was very, you know, it's like I say, family got me through a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing some of that. I mean, it's just so important for everyone to have examples of coming back from adversity and overcoming and just coming from a deep place. Anyway, so thank you for touching on that.
And I will say something. That's something my children now, who are all grown adults in their 30s, who come back and said, you know, Dad, that's something we all learned is how you just keep moving forward. You know, when you have disappointments, you're going to have them. I don't care what you do in life. You're going to have them. And they said, we've watched you reinvent yourself several times. And, you know, if there's something that you want to do, we have no doubt you could do it if you really want to do it.
Yeah. What an amazing example to set for your children, you know, and for them to witness you, they're going to model what you do. So, yeah. Okay. So you decided to turn towards trading it, and you're telling us about the education that you were pursuing. Let's pick up there.
So, like I said, and actually was the reason I even got into trading was a good friend of mine from high school, who's an insurance agent of mine, told me, you know, he said, why don't you go trade the markets? I said, I don't know the first thing about the markets, because all my businesses, I really pretty much invested back in my own company. I didn't invest in the markets. And he goes, well, you like putting together deals. And he goes, you put a deal together every day in the markets. So that's pretty much how I started off on that track, and sort of interesting. You know, I went out and opened up an account in commodities, started trading commodities. And I remember the first trade I ever made was on frozen concentrated orange juice. You can actually trade orange juice futures and out of New York. So I made a trade, put in a trade, and I made, I think, like $450. But it was pretty quick. And I thought, wow, this was easy. I'm back on easy street. I'm just going to, you know, parlay this right back on back. I'll be back up, you know, in the millions again. So I promptly did that until I lost everything I had. So it didn't take long because I didn't have much money to be working with. So when I did that, I learned two things. Number one, I learned, yes, you can make money in the markets. And number two, I didn't know how to do it yet. So I set out to start learning how to do this. And like I said, this was, you know, pre, you know, prolific internet days. And so grab every book I could read on the markets. I would call the author of the book and actually say, hey, you know, I track them down and say, hey, you know, I would love it if you would just, you know, spend a few hours with me. I'd be glad to pay you for your time. I'll buy you lunch. I'll travel to wherever you are. Just tell me how to do this. And so I literally traveled all over the country looking for people and learning how to try to trade. And it was a trial and error thing. So found out real quick, you know, it was more about risk management than it is about making money. That's what I learned more about in the markets was risk management. That's really what you are as a trader. You're a risk manager. That's what you are. So I learned a lot about that in trial and error. But then after a while, I got pretty good at it to where I had a track record. And then people were wanting to give me money to trade for them. So that's sort of how I parlayed it into a hedge fund.
Okay. And then you were in hedge funds for a while. Can you tell us what that was like?
I guess that's sort of a term that's thrown around out there. It was a private investment fund is what it was. People would give me their money and I got licensed to trade, you know, manage their accounts and trade everything for them. And I pulled a percentage profits for it for doing that. And I did that mainly because starting out, I didn't have a large amount of money to trade myself. So this was a way to take my skills, get paid for it. So I would trade their accounts and trade my accounts also. And that's how I did that. I did that for several years.
Okay. Yeah. And I think you mentioned that it was successful. And then in 2008, can you tell us about, you know, how that changed, how that journey changed for you over the years?
Right. And so I was trading, so let me back up just a tad bit here. So I was trading commodities starting in 98. Well, on 9/11, I was trading the market when the planes hit the tower and the Pentagon and everything. So, and everybody, if you're old enough to remember what it was like then. I mean, everything shut down for a while. And it was such that my brokers were located in New York. I couldn't get a hold of my brokers. I was in open positions in natural gas trading. I had no idea what the situation was. I had no idea if my broker was even alive because I knew he was in Tower 7 that was evacuated and got crushed by one of the other towers when it fell on it. But so it's one of those kind of things where I didn't know what was going on. But he called me from his cell phone a couple of days later and told me, you know, this is where the situation is. And so I was able to get through that time. It was a little crazy there for a while when they opened the markets back up. It was very volatile and, you know, it could have cost me a lot of money, but I was able to get out pretty flush with it. And then that's why I stepped back and said, I need something that's a little bit more liquid than what I was trading in the commodities market and something that I could trade in and out of a lot faster. So that's sort of how I got into the Forex market, which stands for foreign exchange. Currency trading is what that is. And it was sort of the wild, wild west back then. So in 2002, that's why I moved over and started trading the currency markets and still trade a little bit of commodity, but mainly was the currencies. And that's what I've done most of in the last, since 2002, was trading currencies. And that's when I also set up those investments funds in with trading currencies.
Okay. Can you explain what that means for our listeners who aren't so familiar with what trading currencies is?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Sure. It's the simplest way I can say is when you, let's take the U.S. dollar and then the euro. Well, those are two different currencies from two different countries, but they also have a fluctuation. If you've ever gone to the airport or ever traveled internationally, you've probably traded currencies because if you're going to go to Europe, when you land, if you're going to spend euros, you're going to have to go over there and buy some euros. So how are you going to buy the euros? Well, you're going to buy them and pay for them with your U.S. dollar. So that's how it's done. Now, the rate, the currency exchange rate is like, okay, like right now it's probably trading right around $1.15. It takes $1.15 U.S. dollars to buy 1 euro. So that's how you're trading it. And then as the rates change and they fluctuate constantly, 24 hours a day, 5 days a week, they do close on Friday afternoons. But then they open up Sunday afternoons because that's where the markets open in Japan, in the Far East, that's where the day begins. So when you're trading currency, you're just trading one against the other is what that is. That's all trading currencies are. And you're waiting for the difference of the rate. And you think, well, how did they move that quickly? Well, they move in, you know, one small increments. It doesn't trade just at a penny in time. It trades in 1/100th of a penny. So you say, how can you make any money do that? Well, it's done with the leverage. So you control large blocks of money. So if you're controlling $1 million worth of currency, it does not have to move very far if you make a lot of money if you're controlling $1 million worth of currency. So that's essentially how it works.
Okay, great. So you got into currency trading and then what happened like 2008, 2015, you know, when there was more regulations? Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, so this sort of goes into what happens with currencies. Why do they even move? Well, usually for a currency, think of a currency, how what it considers value, how is it valued? Sort of like the stock of that country. You know, it'd be like if they had a stock on traded on the market. So, well, it'd be their currency. That's, is their currency valuable? Well, the U.S. dollar is the, you know, the reserve currency of the world. So, yes, it's got, you know, stability and all that kind of stuff. So when you're looking at trying to make a decision, and sort of got sidetracked on your question there, the markets change based off of interest rates. That's sort of what drives the value of the currency. So think back to 2008 and during the market crash. What did the banks do back when that happened? If you think about right before it happened, you're looking at interest rates of the countries, different countries, you know, U.S. or in Britain and Europe, they're all probably trading up, you know, in the 5% and 6% range was their Fed interest rates. Well, the difference in the interest rates is usually what drives a lot of the value of the currency. And so interest rates don't change rapidly. So it's a very steady curve. That's what makes currency trading great, or used to, because it was a slow process. They don't go in there and just go from 4 or 5% interest rate down to, you know, 2%. They gradually do that. So, but as those gradually start changing, that will start driving the value of that currency one direction or the other. So you trade one against the other. Now, in 2007 and 8, when the housing crash started happening, they started lowering interest rates. Is now it was a race to the bottom. So everybody started lowering rates, lowering. So now where are we sitting at right now? Well, everybody's sitting, you know, at almost 0% interest. Well, if there's no interest differential between the U.S. dollar and the euro or anybody else, there's not going to be much movement. So now what you have is nothing but a bunch of choppiness and manipulation and rumor mill. That's pretty much started happening in 2008 and 2009. And it's just really never has gotten back because of that. And it won't until there's really something you can do. Now, granted, the markets move if you were looking at a chart of them, but they're not consistently. It just jumps back and forth. It's a high-risk environment. And like I say, it's not as predictable as it used to be. So that's why I got out of it. So it was everybody's race to the bottom as far as interest rates, which has been a blessing for the real estate market, though.
Okay, perfect segue. So from commodities to currencies, and then you turn to real estate. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, let's talk about that. What was attractive about real estate and why did you get into it and how has that been since then?
Well, one of the things that was attractive about it was a hard asset. Like I said, you know, a stock can go to zero. You can have massive manipulation of interest rates and things by the government as far as, you know, that it could affect the currencies. And you can have tremendous intervention by the federal banks on their currencies, interest rates also. So when I looked at something and said, what can I get into that has, you know, has value that's going to be their real store of assets? And that was pretty much real estate. And I had dabbled in real estate in the 90s when I had logistics warehousing companies, so industrial real estate. So I knew the value and how it worked. The biggest thing I didn't like about real estate was the leverage factor, believe it or not, mainly because as a guy that went bankrupt, I didn't like debt. So that was one reason I didn't, you know, go into any kind of real estate before that. But then as the interest rates started piling back down, then the leverage looked more attractive. And it was, I guess you can say it's good debt. It's not go out and, you know, it's not credit debt or credit card debt or something like that. Real estate debt is an appreciating asset with cash flow. So that was good. And then as interest rates started coming down, it became more and more attractive too. So,
okay. Awesome. So what was your first move when you were getting into real estate?
Well, first thing I did was try to find some mentors and who could help me figure out how to do this, because, you know, I know how to run a business, but real estate, especially investment real estate, is a whole different. It's got a business component to it, which I like, but you still need to know what you're doing. So I tried to find people who would help me do that. Got involved in some small multifamily stuff up near Chicago area, like a brownstone. So it's like a 6-7 unit brownstone. Got involved in one of those. And then I realized real quick, okay, this is multifamily, but my goodness, this is really hard to scale to kind of make any kind of money for me from that perspective. So I thought I've got to get into bigger multifamily and started looking at it saying, okay, I really need to get into like 100+ units. Well, now you're stepping up to a whole different ballgame as far as just the pricing value and getting financing. And I don't care what your net worth is. If you don't have experience in multifamily, you're not going to get a loan from a bank, from Fannie Mae or Freddie, to do a multifamily that size if you don't have the credibility behind that. So that's when I need to bring some partners in. And I didn't have a whole lot of partners in my past as my past business dealing. So, you know, bring that part of it into, you need a lot of, it takes a lot of moving parts and a lot of people on a team to make a large multifamily project work out. So that's when I started looking to bring in partners and who could help me get this done. And that's pretty much when I started realizing, okay, to scale this, I'm going to have to get into the bigger multifamily stuff. And that's what I started doing and looking at in 2016 and 17.
Okay. Well, that was a pretty good time to be getting into multifamily.
Yes.
Can you tell me like just some lessons learned or some stories from, you know, what worked at that time, what didn't work?
Well, the biggest, you know, there's two things you need when you're going into multifamily. You have two things. You have deal. You need to have deal flow, which means you got to be able to look at some properties, and you have to have, be able to raise money. So you're always constantly doing one of those two things. I'm constantly doing that. So deal flow. So that's going out there and finding, you know, properties to be that are being sold. Well, it's one thing to go out there and you go out and look at all the listings. Well, everybody else is seeing them too. So guess what? You're just one number in the crowd, and how are you going to step out among everybody else? Plus, you get into these bidding wars. So whoever wins actually loses most of the time because they're the ones who end up paying too much, but they want the deal. So I let them have the deal. So I learned pretty quickly. I started cultivating relationships with brokers. That's what I've had to do, is because if you cultivate a relationship with a broker and they know you can actually do the deal and close the deal, because that's their biggest concern. Can you close this deal? If you can prove that to them and you get one under your belt, then they'll start bringing you more deals, and they're called pocket listings and they're off market. So you get a shot at it before it hits the big market to see if you can get the deal done and tied up before anybody else even knows about it. Well, that's what you got to do in this business. So, and I'm constantly, you know, working on those relationships with those brokers to bring me deals, because now I've got the reputation that I can get them done. And that's how it sort of works. So,
yeah, for sure. And, you know, this is a common topic in our circle. What recommendations would you have to folks who are looking to build those relationships with brokers?
Take the time, make the trip. It depends on where you live, obviously. But you got to spend some money and go places and spend some time in that area, learning that market and going, and you need to go see those brokers. It may mean going by them and saying, hey, I'm a live person. I really want to do some deals to get them to pay attention to you. So you got to spend some time doing that. Now, depending on what market you're in. Now, I live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. That's probably the multifamily capital of the world. And so there's a lot of people doing that here. So it's a big pond, and you're going to be a little fish in a big pond. So I started going out looking at what we call the tertiary markets, some of your smaller markets. And I know a lot of my friends and stuff that are doing that now are starting looking at those smaller cities, you know, like the Tulsa, Oklahoma's, the Little Rock, Arkansas's, some of the smaller cities. Corpus Christi, Texas is a big market. You know, it's not a big market, but it's a very good market now, just like I've done. And Lubbock, Texas, you know, is where I've got three properties right now, over 400 doors up there. So, and those are tertiary markets that there's not as many people, wasn't as many people, I will clarify that, wasn't as many people. Now they're starting to, you know, it's starting to get a little bit of attention, but you could find better deals up there to get better returns. And when I say, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth is a crowded market, it doesn't mean there's not deals here, but it's hard to find the kind of returns that most of my investors were looking for. So they would be a lot smaller returns if you're going to invest in Dallas-Fort Worth. So from that perspective, I went out to the smaller markets to get those returns.
For sure. Awesome. Well, Tracy, I know that we have a lot more that we can talk about, and I definitely want to have you on some more to just go more in depth into your multifamily investing and what you're doing now, how you've pivoted. So, but for now, let's just... You gave us a ton of great information, a ton of value. We can't wait to have you on next time. Why don't you take a minute and share with the listeners how they can get in touch with you and anything else you'd like to share?
Sure, I'd love to. Thank you. My website is hubbardcapitalgroup.com. That's H-U-B-B-A-R-D, capitalgroup.com. And you can go there and find all my contact information. That's our website. And you'll notice also in there, other than multifamily, we also do agricultural and vineyard syndications now in Texas. So go check it out and see if there's anything you're interested in. Give me a call. I'd love to talk to you about it.
Awesome, everyone. Definitely check out Tracy's website, and we'll make sure to have you on again very soon to talk about your real estate investing experience more in depth. Thanks so much, Tracy. See you next time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, and I look forward to coming back.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.